It's the 40th anniversary of the release of Klaatu's third album, Sir Army Suit. An amazing feat, really. 40 years later, people are still loving it and being affected by it, and it's still a part of their lives. And the work has maintained its stature as a shining example of a classic pop album. A really momentous thing. Talk about how you feel having something that you created 40 years ago still in the public consciousness as it is.
Well, it's extremely gratifying that people are still appreciating the music. It's a little bit of a surprise as well, because I never would have guessed back then that it would have this kind of longevity.
It is really pretty amazing. I mean, it's down to the quality of the songwriting and the quality of the production and the artwork and everything, the entire package. Talk about when it was time to record a third album, because you'd just come off of Hope, which was a concept album, had orchestration in it. It was a whole different kind of thing. Maybe the closest to, you know, when a lot of people will say that Klaatu is very prog. And although I've really never heard that before, I don't hear the prog in it. But I guess you might be able to pin that label on Hope. So coming off of Hope, and it's time to get a third album, what was the mindset among the group? What were you thinking about how to proceed with a third album and what kind of songs you would do and the kind of mood overall that it would be?
Well, we didn't want to do another concept album after Hope. I mean, we had done that, and we sort of got back to doing individual pop tunes as opposed to a thematic album. We were also getting some gentle nudges from the record label Capitol at that time that they were kind of asking us to get into something that's a little bit more radio-friendly. So, you know, we essentially went back to similar to formula of the first album, except maybe even a little bit more commercially targeted. Because the first album really, even though it's a collection of individual tunes, we never really thought of it as a concept or anything, but at the same time, we weren't overly concerned about airplay. We were more just trying to do something that we really wanted to do, as opposed to whether we're being told to do it. But as I say, on the Sir Army Suit album, we were getting some hints that they like us to move a little bit more towards something that could get airplay. So that's really accounts for the impetus for doing it. Plus, we had some songs already written that sort of fall under that category. Dear Christine, for example, was written back in 1971, so we had that in the offing and a few others. And as I say, the Hope album, I mean, we did the concept thing, you know, we did that once, and we certainly didn't consider ourselves a concept band per se.
Well, yeah, but talk about the Klaatu sound. I mean, I've seen it spoken about, or rather in print, about doing the songs, doing your songs your way rather than how they were done on Endangered Species, which was more Capitol's way. So you go into a third album. You had the first album was different songs, was disparate songs, and then you have a concept album, and now the third album, and all throughout those albums and all those songs, you sounded like Klaatu because you had a kind of a fanciful sound, a way of expressing yourselves that was different from everybody else. So you've got that in the back of your mind. So how do you approach with the idea of doing shorter songs, not necessarily ones that would get played on the radio, but how do you approach these songs? Because they're different. I mean, you know, the songs that are on Sir Army Suit are different. So how do you approach all that and have it still come out the Klaatu way?
Well, the key word in your question there is different. We strove to have every song be different from every other song. We were never fans of albums by groups where you play the album. You could pick the needle up and down and put it anywhere on the album, and it would always sound the same. We were more into trying to be versatile if we could. And so we consciously tried to make each song sound different from the ones before it and after it. So I think that that has a lot to do with the sound. We spend a heck of a lot of time working on sounds, trying to find unique new sounds. And we were very fortunate because for the first three albums, we had Terry Brown as our producer, and he was right into it the same way we were. So we didn't. It wasn't like we had to go through a filter, and then have everything that we wanted to do pared back. He was, if anything, he was as enthusiastic or more enthusiastic than we were to get something that was sonically different.
Well, it's interesting in recorded history, in popular recordings history, it's very hard to find records or by bands that had that kind of latitude. You know, usually it was, you know, the record company coming to check up on listening to mixes, you know, oh, we don't like that, do something different, that's not a good single, you know, whatever the case was. But you really did have an enormous amount of creative freedom to stay in your group headspace and have it come out the way that you wanted.
Yeah, and that was largely because for the first three albums, we had Terry Brown there between us and the record company. And, you know, he definitely was not just in it for, you know, make the money aspect of it. He definitely was plugged into, you know, trying to make an artistically pleasing album as well as one that may or may not sell. But it wasn't like dealing with a record company executive in a suit. You know, Terry was really more like one of the band, actually, than our relationship wasn't really your conventional artist-producer relationship. Mm. We had a very tight ship, and Terry was part of that ship.
Well, let's talk about some of your songs that were on Sir Army Suit. I've told you this before, and I've talked about it over and over again through the years, but the way I first heard anything from this album was when I was living in Delaware and I was listening to a Philadelphia radio FM station. I can't remember which one. But anyway, they played A Routine Day. And honestly, I had no idea who had done it, but I was just transfixed on it. I thought, wow, what is this? And in those days, you could actually call up a disc jockey and he would answer the phone. So,
right?
I mean, that shows you how long ago it was. And that's what I did, and I talked to the guy, and I said, tell me who that is, because I have to have this record, like, now. And we talked about the song, about how sophisticated it was, yet how accessible. It wasn't sophistication for sophistication's sake. It was a very accessible number. We're going to actually talk about it in a separate time. We'll talk about A Routine Day, but I wanted to talk about some of the other ones that maybe don't get talked about as much. The other song that always struck me as should have been a hit, should have been, you know, going up the Billboard charts with a bullet, as they used to say, was Juicy Lucy, because it struck me as being just the catchiest thing, very compact, concise, did its thing, got out of there. Talk about the writing of that and the production, and whether you think the final version of it that got on the record hit the mark as you heard it in your head.
Right. Well, actually, that song originated, the writing of it originated back into, I think, 1975. The version that it originally, you know, that I originally wrote was somewhat different melodically to what I ended up with, but I actually did a studio demo recording of Juicy Lucy back in 1975, I think it was, and then it just sat on the shelf because then the Hope album came along and it wasn't going to fit that concept. When it came time to do the Sir Army Suit album, I sort of pulled it off and dusted it off again, but after gaining the objectivity of not listening to it for a year or so, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to, you know, make some changes to the melody, make it simpler. And that was really all there was. It was just, that song was never anything that was intended to be overly ambitious or anything. Mm-hmm. It really turned out to be just like a spoof of disco. At least that's what where my head was at that time. Because by the time we got around to doing it, disco was everywhere. Mm-hmm. It had totally taken over the music scene. So, but the production of it was recorded at a studio in Toronto here called Sounds Interchange, And we hired some really top brass people, brass musicians. I don't know if you know Mo Kaufman's name, but
No.
he's quite a he's deceased now, but he was quite he's one of the best session players in Canada. And that was the other thing too. We were so lucky. We got to work with some really great musicians, and they really played their arses off on Juicy Lucy. In fact, I listened to it in prep for this interview. I just listened to it again because I haven't heard it for like 4 or 5 years, and they're really blowing a lot of smoke out there. It's just fabulous brass, tight and very well played. And so it was really just it wasn't intended to be anything really lofty or deep. It was just like a fun tune, and that's how I approached it. And it went through, as I say, it went through a metamorphosis before it actually reached its final version. But and now, in terms of whether or not we captured it 100% to my satisfaction, I don't know if you ever capture anything to 100% to your satisfaction. Although I can't think of anything I would have done differently on the first album. The first album is I'm totally satisfied with what we ended up with. But you know, being you know, competitive and constantly questioning yourself. You know, you sometimes say, "Gee whiz, I wish we would have had something a little different in this part, or maybe that vocal harmony could have been stronger, or you know, whatever." Self-criticism is a healthy part of the creative process.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was talking before about that I really never heard the prog stuff like other people did. It's the same with this song. I'd heard about the disco, you know, disconnection, so to speak, but it never sounded to me like it had any connection to disco at all. It just sounded like a fun pop tune, like something I would love to hear on the radio after a set of commercials, you know, which bored me to tears. Then this song would come on, and I'd be like, "Hey, that's pretty cool." So it's interesting. It's interesting that it had its genesis, you know, in that way. It's very interesting. Another one is I want to talk about Dear Christine, because this is just, it's one of the loveliest songs that you guys ever did. Very period sounding, real entrancing melody and vocals, and a terrific melodic bass line, which all your songs have. You were just a monster bass player on those records.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I just love the way you play. I mean, you know, sometimes there's a little McCartney-ism in there, but your style of playing was always really interesting and fun for me. And then the story, you know, the story in the song about romance, you know, that will hopefully come to pass when the narrator returns from the high seas. You know, very romantic, very almost historical in nature. You co-wrote this song, and I hope I pronounced the name right, because I'm terrible with pronunciations. It was Adino Tomei. Was that how you pronounced his
Yeah,
last name?
that's good. Yep.
Okay. So you wrote that with Adino Tomei. You also co-wrote Sub Rosa Subway, among other things. Talk about the writing of the song and how it progressed through to the final version on the album.
Well, that song again, its genesis started in 1971, and it was the idea for the song came from was inspired by the movie Billy Budd with Darren Stamp. I believe it was directed by Peter Ustinov, who also plays the captain of the ship. And it's a story about you know, 18th century British sailors or whatever. And I thought, gee, you know, I've always liked period stuff. I mean, like, look at Sub Rosa Subway. I mean, that's a period thing as well. So that's where the idea came from. And I think I was also maybe influenced by a video that the Hollies did for Dear Eloise back in 67 or 8, whenever that came out, which I saw on TV, where Graham Nash is using a quill pen, pretending he's writing a letter to his girlfriend, or what, Dear Eloise, I guess. And so that's sort of like where I drew it from. And I got my father's atlas out and looked up names of British towns on the south coast, and I came up with Bournemouth, and so that became part of the lyric. And Dino's contribution largely was the melody on the originally was on guitar, but the harmonium melody that comes half, you know, in the body of the tune, and at the intro, that lovely melody is Dino came up with that. And so we had this demo that actually, when I first met Terry Brown, and Dee and I first met with him, an audition in a sense, where we both provided him with some demo tapes of our songs. Dear Christine was actually part of my demo tape. And so, and that was like 1972. So it didn't really show up on a Klaatu album until the third album. But as far as the production is concerned, it's largely similar to what I had envisioned originally, except that there was a third verse that I ended up cutting out, and just using a repetition of the chorus with a modulation at the end there. And as far as the production is concerned, we got a really nice string arrangement done by a gentleman named Eric Robertson up here in Canada, who was an arranger and musician, composer of his own right. And so we had you know, everything we really wanted. You know, like we were never denied anything with Terry Brown. If we said we wanted strings, we got strings. And you know, expenses not to be put above artistic endeavor here. So we were very fortunate in that way. And I'm relatively pleased with the way it worked out. It's a nice sounding track.
I was listening yesterday. I was listening to Sgt. Pepper again, which I'm wont to do every so often. And I was watching also the documentary, The Making of Sgt. Pepper. And it was interesting. At one point, George Martin was talking about what his role was with the band after the first couple of albums. You know, and he said, I was basically a facilitator, you know, the guy who translated their ideas into reality. You know, John would come and say, I don't want my voice to sound like me, and he'd have to come up with a way to make that happen. So
right.
Terry Brown was really your George Martin.
Oh, absolutely. And then his partner, Doug Riley, was sort of like the person who you would turn to for written arrangements and things like that if you needed them. In fact, Doug Riley, who was Terry's partner, he scored the Hope album.
Yeah, well, that's great too. All your work is so terrific. But this song, Dear Christine, that's one of my favorites. I love how it gets a little sort of dramatic towards the very end, you know, when the last chorus comes in. Bum, 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 you know, and then you sing, and the rhymes are so musical, and it's great. Well, it's terrific. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Sir Army Soup, believe it or not, 40 years, unbelievable, right here with John Wallace Chuck from Klaatu. And now I want to talk about Tokimore Field, which is another one of your great songs on the album, about a magical place, and I love the words, you know, it's a lilting song floats upon the air, you know, where a smile or a young girl's face brings out the sun for a while. I mean, that whole idea. Tokimore Field being the place where love comes alive. Am I remembering this correctly? Did you talk once with me about you had the Young Rascals in mind for the sound of this one?
Yeah. I was a big Rascals fan, and they had more than a couple, but two of the songs there's one called How Can I Be Sure, and another one called With a Girl Like You, and they, you know, they were very musical. Their writing was really quite good. They were sort of, I guess you could call them sort of R&B, maybe a cross between R&B and rock, I suppose. Mm. But I've always admired their music. And in fact, the first band I was ever in, we used to do predominantly R&B and the Animals. That's you know, we were just a band that did covers. We didn't write or anything.
Mm.
But so I got a, you know, fairly good appreciation of R&B and, you know, from my beginning when I first started playing with bands. And, I mean, Klaatu's not really R&B, I understand that. But there is still there is some influences still there that hang around. So I think you could look at Tokyo Moore Field as sort of being that kind of an R&B thing, but with a lot of Technicolor paints thrown all over it, and you know, a little bit, a lot of colorations and different sounds, and you know, psychedelic. I always thought of it as, you know, back in those days, adult contemporary we used to be called middle of the road or MOR.
Right.
And I've always thought of this song as being a psychedelic MOR.
Right. Well, that's you know, you're right. It kind of is. And it also has that, you know, once again, I use that word fanciful ending, you know, where the bass is kind of popping around up and down and, you know, to Tokyo Moore Field, you know, that whole thing at the end.
Yeah.
It must have been very liberating. You know, I know we keep sort of hitting on this point, but it must have been very liberating to come up with a song like this and then have it produced in a way that, really, it was just, you guys were really in your own pocket. It's kind of amazing.
Well, we were kind of insulated from the world, too. We weren't paying a heck of a lot of attention to what was happening contemporaneously at the time we were doing this, you know. We had our own agenda. We had our own musical tastes, which were founded in you know, the music that we liked as we were growing up. And we totally ignored, or as much as we could, you know, what was all the noise that was going around us. And, you know, we intentionally tried to be different, but at the same time, we also tried to be, you know, do the best we could do, you know, get the, you know, the arrangement always had to be done in such a way that it absolutely amplified the essence of whatever the song was. Mm. So whatever the song really was, you know, you had to, we sort of tried to explore how it was. And actually, what we used to do was when we were working in the studio, we were, you know, on playbacks, you know, we tried to picture ourselves as being a listener who'd never heard it before, and you know, try to find out how it impacts you as you're listening to it, and then making adjustments accordingly. And a lot of the arrangement ideas came that way, where, you know, you'd have like three of us plus Terry Brown in the studio brainstorming about what we should do next to it. And, you know, somebody would come up with an idea that you try, and not every idea worked, but sometimes you came up with some really good ones. And, you know, one of the things about Tokyo Moore Field that I'm happy, well, not happy, but I'm pleased about how it worked out is the modulation into the last verse. It really, I had somebody was talking to me the other day about how that modulation is, they use some really flowery language to describe how, what kind of effect it had and everything, how great they thought it was. And it is a well, you know, not all modulations are created equal.
Right.
And if you can back yourself into a modulation without the audience realizing what you're doing, and then you know, and then take them somewhere once you get there, it is kind of rewarding. So that worked out well. That was, you know, not every modulation that I've ever done has been as effective as that one.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of interesting, you know, as I was saying about that last chorus, it's kind of a little bit funky almost, as opposed to the rest of the song. So it does take you somewhere else, as all the songs do on the album. You know, it's just, it's that Klaatu sound.
We tried to make music, regardless of what genre we were trying to go for, we tried to make it as visual as possible. Now, I know it sounds crazy, because you don't see with your ears. But the colorations and everything that we used, the different sounds that we used, our whole approach was really to try and come up with something that was really more of an environment rather than just a song. And that every song should be as completely fulfilled, you know, its potential should be reached as best you could do it. Like, you know, take it to the nth degree, and hopefully that you don't go past the nth degree, in which case it ends up sounding like you've overworked it. But there is a visual quality to, and it's, you know, some of it has to do with the lyrics, but also some of it has to do with the music and the arrangement of the music.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, also different tonations, like in Juicy Lucy, the background vocals, you know, it sounds like a bunch of sort of high-pitched kids or girls singing.
Yeah, we had a professional session singer who also did the vocal on California Jam in the middle, and the Mythical Malibu part.
All right.
Her name's Lori Hood, and she was, you know, she was in a group in Canada up here called, I think it was called the Candy Shop or something, but she also was a session singer, and she had this lovely, sweet little voice. The first time I heard her voice was on a toilet paper commercial.
No.
And it was like the softest, softest, fleecy soft or something like that.
Yeah.
And she had this beautifully airy voice. And I remember asking Terry Brown, I said, you know, this voice would be perfect. Do you know who this person is? He said, oh, yeah, it's Lori Hood. Yeah, she works on the sessions. We do a lot of session work with her. So we got her to do that. And so on Juicy Lucy, we had her on that as well. And she does a great job. She had a nice voice.
So 40 years ago, I believe in the U.S. it was August 1st, if I'm correct, that this album was released. But 40 years ago this month, and we've got two other albums to think about with anniversaries coming up. But I think the whole point of all of this is not only to celebrate this great album, Sir Army Suit, but also to say, hey, if you haven't listened to the other albums in a long time, or maybe not at all, maybe you're new to Klaatu, this is a good time to really dig in and listen to these great records. So, John, thanks for talking about Sir Army Suit on the 40th anniversary of its release. It really remains a terrific album.
Well, thank you, Alan, for inviting me on your show. I really appreciate it.